Good afternoon. I'm Linda Schreier, co-author of Tears and Tequila, and I'm here with Megan Devine, a woman I call the muse of the grieving. Hi, Megan.
Hi, Linda.
How are you?
I'm well, thanks. I always love that title. I forget that that's what you call me, so every time I hear it, it makes me laugh.
Yes. Well, Megan, you and I got to know one another, although we've never met and we've never actually talked till now.
I know. Isn't that strange? It seems like we have.
I know. It feels like we know one another very well through the miracle of online. Well, we did a fabulous interview on that Tears and Tequila Talks website we've got. And I'm so impressed by the work that you do. And I know quite a bit about the way in which you got started, the tragic way in which you got started. Mm. And I guess if you don't mind, I would love to ask you if you would explain that to our listeners.
Sure. I can give you the, it seems so strange, but the elevator speech of death.
Yeah.
So I've been a psychotherapist for 10-something years. And in 2009, I was very tired of sitting and listening, and I was ready to quit. And with my partner, Matt, we were planning to move out of where we were living and sort of start over with new careers. And just when we had made those plans, we went out on July 12th, 2009, for a quick swim in our home river, and he drowned, which is still really hard to say. You know, a little over 5 years now, it's still like, excuse me, what happened? So being a therapist actually didn't prepare me in any way for experiencing that, for living through that sudden death. And what I found for sort of grief resources or shock resources after that happened, they just it didn't work for me, and that's kind of putting it politely.
Why is that? Why didn't they work for you?
Well, the grief landscape, the support landscape has changed actually quite a bit in the last 5 years. It's not awesome yet, but it's a lot better than it was back then. When I went looking, a lot of what I found was from a religious standpoint, which was not useful for me because that's not really my framework. You know, talking about you'll see them again, you'll be reunited, you know, lean on God, those sorts of things, that didn't help me. So there was sort of the religious arm of things. There was another sort of psychology self-help arm branch of things that was like, you can bounce back from this and your life can be even better than it was. And That struck me as really deeply offensive, that my life could be better because I just watched my partner die. Like that, that's such an offensive message to somebody who's in pain, that somehow this happened so that their life could be better. And that's pretty much what I found. And, you know, some of the worst offenders were from, like, the psychology field or the therapy field, really just not getting it. What I did find was sort of a small, by sort of this hunt and peck thing and following the trail of blogs, sort of the breadcrumb trail of blogs, to find sort of a small band of people who are widowed around my age whose lives had been somewhat similar to mine before death showed up in their lives. And we formed this little band, really leaning on each other and telling the truth to each other. And I don't know that I would say that finding those people helped me survive, because who knows what it would have been like without them, but I'm very glad that I don't have to know what it's like without that. So finding that companionship, just that validation and that acknowledgement of the sheer suckage of what happened. That's what I was really looking for, and I didn't find it as a sort of a cultural response or a therapeutic response. I found it with the people who are walking in it with me.
You know, what's so funny, I mean, what's so interesting about that is that I wrote Tears and Tequila with a woman named Joanne Lautman, and mm-hmm. Joanne founded a grief center in Los Angeles 20 years ago mm-hmm. called Our House. And it was founded on the concept and belief that people who've experienced grief need to be with people their own age
yeah.
and their own circumstances.
Absolutely.
And it was based on that the grief group in Tears and Tequila was created out of fictional characters, but,
right.
you know, who embodied some of the characters that Joanne has worked with through the years. And Joanne still says to this day that she believes that the way that a person can get through grief, you know, it's not easy and it's not always something you can get through, but that the best way is to connect with people your own age in your own circumstances where you can find, as you said, that acknowledgement and the validation and the companionship. So
absolutely.
It's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting to hear that. Did you go to any real life grief groups or did you primarily do it online?
I tried one and it was such new territory for me. I mean, I wasn't dumb before this happened, you know, like the inner world, sort of self-work and emotional intelligence, all of those things, they weren't new to me.
Right.
But all of those skills that I had were pretty irrelevant for a loss of this scale.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried everything, and I'm not much of a group person. I run groups all the time,
yeah.
but as a participant, it's hard for me. But I did try an in-person support group, which I'm still kind of amazed that I tried. It was okay. One of the things that was tricky for me was that a lot of the people in the group had known each other before. Probably 75% of the group were widowed by cancer. And so they had sort of been together as a pod through their partner's illnesses and diagnosis and death and hospice
mm-hmm.
and all of those things. So they all knew each other. I got some amazing friends out of that group. So don't get me wrong. It was very useful, but it was still not quite right for me. And, you know, because
you
I had done
think that. Yeah, I think it's because you're not a group person as well as because of the fact that they knew one another going in?
I think it probably has a lot of factors, and it was closer to what I needed because people were telling the truth, but
uh-huh.
there's a level of connection and engagement that I'm accustomed to and that I was accustomed to before death. And that's something that you and I have talked about before, during the 30-day writing course that I hold on my site. There's a level of connection and intensity and thought that's sort of my native language, and that wasn't
what was spoken in that group. Excuse me for jumping. I so agree. The 30-day online course that you run, I know your website is called Refuge in Grief. Writing Your Grief is your 30-day online course?
Right. Right.
And I took it this summer, I was kind of one of the dropouts, only because my life and the continual need to be involved with marketing for the novel Tears and Tequila just kept interrupting any flow I tried to get in there. But what I was, which was so fabulous, was a recipient of your gorgeous and insightful daily writing prompt. And I also got mm-hmm. to see your daily comments on the writing by others. And I was so moved by the depth of honesty with which people wrote. I also was so saddened by the level of pain that people
mm-hmm.
were in who take the course. But I was always heartened by your participation. And I can't say enough about this Writing Your Grief online course for anyone who's in grief. You really you are a master, I have to say.
Yeah,
and you tell the truth, and you know the truth when you hear it. And
yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, I love that too. Thank you. And you know, so you and I had our back and forth kind of behind the scenes, because we're friends outside of that writing course. You know, as authors, you know, me with my When Everything Is Not Okay book, and you with Cheers and Tequila, and we have a lot of overlapping territory. You and I
know, and it's, and that's what's so great about that. You said something in one of our conversations that just blew me away, because you talked about sometimes feeling that imposter syndrome, which I feel as, you know, I was so amazed that you said that, because here you have walked in the shoes of, you know, deep, mournful grief for the past 5 years, and yet you mentioned that you sometimes, you know, are afflicted with the feeling of the imposter syndrome. How can I, who am I to, you know, as you know, Megan, I grew up in a house of silent mourning because my grandparents died in the Holocaust. So death was lingering, you know, in every corner and in every closet, and no one talked about it ever. So I grew up in that atmosphere, and I was not taught as a child that you could talk about these things. On the contrary, I got the message that you never talk about this, never, never. So, but yet along the way, as I grew and matured, and like you, I've been involved with psychology and Eastern, I've been involved with Eastern spirituality, uh-huh. and I married a psychologist. So I'm not, you know, all of this is somewhat, it's roads I've traveled down. But when my own mother died 8 years ago, I was struck with such unbelievable grief, and I let it out and I experienced it, all of that. But when I started to work on this book, Tears and Tequila, I felt like an imposter, because I've never counseled a grief group. This is not my story. It was based on the stories by my co-author, Joanne Lautman, but as a storyteller, I had to fictionalize everything, and I had to become every character in order to understand this deeply. But I still, and I hope I pulled it off, and I don't know, I hope it's not insulting to people who are grieving, and I haven't heard that it is, but I definitely experience the feeling sometimes that what right do I have to talk about this? So,
yeah, you know. And you know what I love about that, and listening to you talk about it, and of course knowing you outside of our conversation here today, is I honestly think coming into, whether it's a fiction work or, you know, some of the things that the services and offers that I put out there for grieving people, when we can come to it saying, sort of, you know, checking our backs and checking our orientation to it. And wondering if we're being of good service, right? I think there's something, if we're asking ourselves those questions and being willing to wonder about that, like, that's a big thing, and that's not something that everybody does. Like, there's a humility in it, right? And that's what I really hear from you is I want to do right by this. And I want to honor this, and I'm aiming in that direction, and I'm going to do the best that I can, and I hope that it lands well.
God, I love that you said that. I love that you said that. Yeah, because that's how I feel, and that's all I want from this book, is for people who do read it to feel that they felt that could find themselves on the pages and could leave when they finish feeling a sense of hope for the future, without minimizing the pain. But
yeah, which is such tricky territory, isn't it? It's so hard to do that. Like, how do we balance those things to offer something to live into, right? Some image or some compass point to live into, while at the same time acknowledging really the severity of this. You know, I think that was one of my big dissatisfactions with what was out there for grief support, was for me it always leaned too far to the sort of cheerleading, everything's going to be awesome, And what I like about my work and what I like about your work and the work of some others is that we bring both of those true realities into the picture. They're both invited into the room. You know that yes, there is a way that we can live into this and stay true to ourselves and create something beautiful. At the same time, we really wish you had been able to live out the beautiful life you were living, and we want to acknowledge that. So bringing those two realities into the room at the same time, that's sort of, at least for me, my orientation, and I know you well enough to sort of guess at that for you.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. And I think you do that very well from what I can see of you, from what I know of your work, and from what I know of you as a person. As it turned out, the first of these conversations that I had was with Abby Carter. And
yeah, I
went into that, and I went into that totally, you know, oh my God, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? Why am I the person supposed to talk about this? It shouldn't be me. But through our conversation, Abby said something that really struck me about how after her husband Aaron was killed in the World Trade Center on 9/11, and of course she was plunged into, talk about an out-of-order death and,
absolutely,
you know, extreme suffering. But she went on to say that what it led to was her living what she calls an unintentional life.
Mm-hmm.
And I so relate to living an unintentional life. And what I said to Abby at the time was, I didn't lose my husband, but I did, for example, move in the 80s from my home on the East Coast to follow my husband to the West Coast, only to get divorced once I was out there.
Mm.
And
mm-hmm.
to know absolutely no one here, and have my entire family and everyone I knew, my friends, my whole life, be left behind. And as a result, I made a new life out here.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand an unintentional life, and I wonder if you feel that your work, because of the depth of it, do you have people who come and write with you who have not experienced a death? Have they experienced, like I did, a complete rebooting of a life and divorce and loneliness and, you know, needing to move forward in that way?
Yes. And I would say that probably 90% of the people who have come through the Writing Your Grief course or who I'm working with in some other capacity have experienced a death, either the death of a partner at a young age or the death of a child at any age. But I do have some people who are coming through with different really deep life losses.
Yeah.
Or some life-changing illnesses or injuries that really have skewed the universe as they knew it before. There's something about a bedrock change that sort of marks things differently. And you know, that said, I never put any parameters on the Writing Your Grief course. If you identify as carrying grief in your life, you're welcome. One of the things that's so beautiful about this course is the community that happens.
Uh-huh.
It drops into that deep, I mean, you saw this, it drops into that deep level the very first opening day. It's like, wow, you know, people were really waiting to be not only heard at that level, but spoken to at that level. And we never question each other's loss. You know, it's an incredibly safe community for people to say what's true for them, no matter what that truth is. So everybody is welcome. And as I said, you know, that first part of your question, so the majority of the people are living what we call life after death for some really disorienting, explosive something in their lives. But everybody is welcome.
Yeah, I love that. I wish I had known you in 2008 when my mother passed away, and I just was. She wasn't young, and it took 3 months before she died, but I found myself, I plummeted into a grief the likes of which I had never known. And as I told you when I was closing down her apartment in Manhattan, I did all these rituals where I thanked the light switches for giving her light.
Mm-hmm.
And I left, my last closing thing was to leave lilacs, her favorite flowers, in the apartment for the next owner. I wept, I wailed. I went and I really, really went into it. And then I mourned her for the next year. And people I knew were puzzled and critical of that and wanted me to get over it. And, you know, their reasonable sides told them that I should get over it. And I felt like I am not going to get over this until I'm over it. And as you know, when I did it, after a year, I built this memory palace, which I'm sitting in right now.
Which I can't wait to see.
Which I can't wait for you to see. My mother's art, she was an artist, and she left behind 500 works of art in her New York studio. And I moved them all out here. And I built a building, and they're all in here. And I'm looking at them right now. And I have to say, it gives me great comfort. And as I said, there are wind chimes that I pass on my way out here. And whenever the wind blows, I believe it's my mother, you know, talking to me. So I needed to establish all of that for myself. And that's been a lot of my healing. And you and I have talked about that. And I love the way you validate that. I can't wait till you see it.
Yeah, I can't wait. And I mean, that really encapsulates for me sort of what the foundation of my work is really acknowledging and honoring that everybody has their own rhythm. You know, there is no sort of cookie cutter response to grief. And even though I've been in my own, right, and I'm familiar with this territory, my territory is not your territory. And, you know, having somebody be able to come to a sort of bow to the sovereignty of your own pain and your own love and welcome it and support it and encourage it, like, that's what we're doing, right? That you in your own self and in your own rhythm, found a way to live with the loss of your mom and make it home for you. And no one could have told you how to do that. But the only thing that we could do is like to find that, to find our own sovereignty inside our own grief, because your grief belongs to you the way that your love belongs to you, right? Nobody from the outside can dictate that. And as we come to, you know, as you and I do, trying to support or be there for people in pain, it's like, we want to honor their own inherent knowledge and sovereignty. I keep coming back to sovereignty. It's one of my favorite words. but really being present for that and honoring that. I love the way that both of us do that in our own ways, both personally and in the way that we show up in the world. You know, honoring
I love that.
Honoring that validity for ourselves and for others.
And that it's and I love the word sovereignty, because grief, as we know, is a land of its own. It's its own planet. And each person's grief, as you said, is different from every other person's. And so sovereignty means that we are the ruler of our own grief in a way. It belongs to us. It's our own land. It's the land of our own grief. And no one could, if anyone had told me that I was going to do something like this, build this memory house, I would have laughed in their faces. Of course I wasn't
to
do anything.
It has
that.
To be organic, doesn't it?
And exactly. And yet, having done it, look what happened. And then what's so incredible to me is this is where I sat in this memory palace for the last 5 years, writing this book about grief. So there are no accidents, you know.
Right.
We only think there are, but
Right. There's an architecture that unfolds, and just as you said, you know, from the beginning of it, if somebody had told you, you know, crystal ball, this is what's going to happen, you'd be like, no, right? Because nobody likes being told what to do, and also like things unfold in their own time. And to sort of loop this back to where we started when you asked me how I got into this. You know, when Matt first died, people came to me and said, you're going to be so useful in this. You're going to be an even better therapist and an even better writer. And I really wanted to punch them because, like, I had to go through this so that I could be good at what I do. No. Right? And the truth is, I have built something really beautiful and useful, and I'm really proud of it. And I would love to have been of beautiful use in the world for some completely other reason. But yeah. This is the life that we have, and both of you are like, both of us are like that, you know, that this is the life we've been given, and this is what we've built in it. And if what we've built can be useful to people in pain, awesome. You know, that works.
I think that's the perfect way to end this interview.
Yeah.
I agree with you. If that can be useful to other people in pain, as well as to our own individual growth, the growth of our soul, I agree. Awesome. Awesome that I was born into this household with this terrible, tragic DNA hanging over it. Mm. Awesome. Mm. Because look what it's done for me. It's made me so sensitive to other people and so happy when I encounter someone like you, Megan, who's really working to help others in your own very poetic and beautiful way.
Hmm. Thanks.
Yes. Well, have we done it? Shall we say sayonara?
I think we have. We're running out of time. You and I could probably talk for the next, you know, year or so and
oh,
all of that.
I hope we do. Yeah, I hope we do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. This is really fantastic. I can't wait to hear this.
I know, me too. Exciting.
Okie dokie. So, I guess we both say so long. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Love you. We'll talk soon, okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye.
Okay. Bye.